That's the end of the first half. As the teams head to the locker room, the Spartans lead the Bulldogs by a score.
You guys stink.
Jeez, Coach, we're only down a couple of points.
No, I mean you guys really smell. You need to hit the showers. And here, I got every one of you new bars of soap from the Sterling Soap Company. Each bar is artisan crafted using natural ingredients and essential oils. They also have shave soaps, colognes, beard balm, and a whole lot more. Now get in there.
But Coach, we have another half to play.
I don't care. I can't stand to be around you.
A few minutes later.
All right, bring it in tight. You guys are still playing terrible, but you're smelling great out there. Now listen, you're going to need to stock up for the rest of the season. We got a lot of tough games left. So go to sterlingsoap.com after the game. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com. You got that?
Yes, Coach.
Great. sterlingsoap.com on three. One, two, three.
sterlingsoap.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, old sports, and welcome to the latest episode of the Hello, Old Sports podcast on the Sports History Network. I'm Dan Newman, joined as always by my brother, Andrew Newman. Andrew, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well, Dan. This is our last recording session, most likely before my wedding next weekend. So looking to finish this part of the podcast era on a high note.
Yes, exactly. It's Andrew's wedding coming up on Saturday, the whatever that Saturday is, the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're looking forward to that very much. Yeah, so it's been, it's been a lot of changes since we first started the podcast almost 6 years ago. Andrew's gotten married. I've had a son. And so lots of changes, but the Hello Old Sports podcast continues on. And we are really excited tonight to have another great author here with us as our guest on Hello Old Sports. Mr. Randall Sullivan is the author of The First All-Star Game, Babe Ruth, FDR, and America at the Crossroads. It is the story of the first Major League Baseball All-Star Game almost a century ago. And Randall, thanks so much for joining us and talking to us a little bit here tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a topic that we've not covered. Well, we actually did, just to put in a plug for a very old episode. One of our very first episodes was about the history of the MLB All-Star Game, and we kind of went through and talked about some of the highlights throughout the years, and started obviously with 1933, and we've done episodes on Babe Ruth and John McGraw and that type of thing, but tell us a little bit about what it is that made you want to tell this story.
Well, the beginning of it was feeling a general despair about the state of the country and, the levels of animosity people seem to have for each other that, you know, far greater than I've experienced in my lifetime. And I thought to comfort myself, well, we've survived worse than this. The country mm-hmm. survived the Civil War, and it survived the Great Depression. And then I began to think about the Great Depression, and as I sort of examined the history of it, the timeline, I saw that everything sort of started to finally sort of stabilize and tick back up from the bottom in the late spring and summer of 1933. So I was looking at, well, what happened then? And there were certainly some things connected to the new president, Franklin Roosevelt. But the single event that leaped out at me was the very first Major League Baseball All-Star Game, which no one knew was the first Major League All-Star Game. It was supposed to be a one-off exhibition. But, I realized that the more I learned about it, that it was more than a game. It was something, it didn't just inaugurate a tradition. It sort of marked a turning point. The fact that it came together and worked and was so successful, and that, America's greatest hero, Babe Ruth, rose to the occasion, even though he was on his last legs, was really uplifting for America. And that was the beginning.
Yeah, and it's obviously, I think sometimes there's a tendency, I know there was in my high school history class, to sort of reduce the Great Depression to the stock market crashed in 1929, FDR became president and the New Deal, and then World War II ultimately ended the Great Depression. It's like, okay, well, that's 12 years. There was definitely a lot more detail in there that happened in between. And obviously, we're going to get into the particulars of the All-Star game and, you know, putting it together for the first time. It put me in mind of two different things. One is sort of how, you know, obviously the owners were not going to immediately embrace something like this. And it kind of reminded me how the early days of the World Series, you know, as early as 1904, John McGraw is steadfast against playing the American League. And then by the next year, it's a regular event. And even closer to the time frame, you know, the NFL being against any kind of playoff game for so long. And then in 1932, they hosted a game really as a tiebreaker. And that ends up, you know, hey, this was a good idea. We made money. Let's do a championship game every year. And here we are, Super Bowl 60 or whatever it is, all these years later. So yeah, it's amazing how quickly they can turn around on something if there's money to be made, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm sure money was the singular inducement, but, you know, the way it thrilled the country and, you know, it really, you know, baseball was depressed too during the Great Depression. Virtually attendance at games was less than half of what it had been. Most of the tickets being sold were for the cheap seats. Nearly every team was losing money, and a good number were teetering on the brink of collapse. So, you know, they were desperate to get eyeballs back on baseball, for it to be put back into the, you know, in the center of the American conversation. And, you know, a lot of them were persuaded that this game would do it. And it most certainly did.
It's meant to further the game of baseball, but it's also meant to be an asset and a demonstration for a specific city. It is very much hard. You can't divorce the game with the venue in which it takes place. And tell us a little bit about Chicago and what Chicago was in 1933, and give us a little bit of a context about Chicago in the 1930s.
Well, Chicago was hit by the Great Depression as much or more than any other city in the country, because manufacturing was the hardest hit sector, and that was the main you know, center of Chicago's economy. At the time that, in the spring of 1933, the public school teachers hadn't been paid in 8 months in Chicago. That's how bad it was. And as it happened, Chicago politics were key to the fact that there ever was an All-Star game, because the initiating event was the mayor of Chicago ostensibly going to Miami to meet with the new president-elect, Franklin Roosevelt. But he was also getting away from a trial that was just about to start of Frank Nitti, who'd taken over for Al Capone running the gangs in Chicago. And it came out at the trial that Cermak had ordered police to execute Nitti in order to elevate this other gangster that he thought would be a better partner. So the press in Chicago was anxiously awaiting his return to talk about it, but they never got to, because the assassin who tried to kill Roosevelt missed with all six shots, but one of them caught Cermak, and he died 3 weeks later. So Chicago needed a new mayor.
And also from a baseball point of view, you know, they've got the reputation for crime, Al Capone, mayor was assassinated, corruption, all that stuff. Yeah. But then they've also got the Black Sox scandal is, you know, just over a decade old. So there's really a lot that the city of Chicago is trying to, both within the sport of baseball and externally, there's really a lot that the, plus, you know, I guess the Cubs were good, you know, in the late 20s, early 30s, but, you know, the White Sox have been terrible. So baseball needs a boost in Chicago, maybe more than anywhere else.
Yeah. And don't forget that the commissioner of baseball, the first commissioner of baseball, was a Chicago judge who was a big fan of both the Cubs and the White Sox, as it happened. So, you know, he had a, you know, vested interest in Chicago being successful. You know, the fact is Chicago was in a position where it was sort of stuck with a World's Fair. They'd gotten the idea for staging a World's Fair in 1933, but the vote to fund it, to pass the bond, was on October 28th, 1929, the day before the crash of the stock market. So they vote to spend this $10 million, and the next day, everything, you know, the floor falls out from under everything. And the fact the guy who was the man who was the head of the commission to run the World's Fair became public enemy number one. Franklin Roosevelt made him, you know, his prime target in his first campaign for the presidency and promised the people, "I'm going to get him." He fled to Europe. And so Chicago had to, you know, reconfigure in every way. So anyway, after Cermak is dies in Miami, the sewer contractor who actually ran the city of Chicago essentially appoints this guy who's been a long, faithful servant of his, Nash, to be the new mayor. But Nash, you know, once he's the mayor, he has some power and he really wants to put his signature on this World's Fair. So he decides that, you know, we should have some great athletic contest, maybe a horse race or a boxing match. He goes to the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, Colonel McCormick, and, you know, says, "Will you help me out with this?" He said, "Well, you know, nobody could do this better than my sports editor, Arch Ward." So he brings Ward in, and Ward says, no. What we should have is a baseball game between the best players in the American League against the best players in the National League. And that was the inception.
It's interesting to think of that guy escaping political problems here into the tranquil shores of Europe in the mid-30s.
They chased him from country to country. There was a Chicago Tribune headline, "All Europe Hunting Insult." And when they finally brought him back, he was acquitted on all charges.
So I guess we should talk about just sort of the legwork it took to get this game actually to be, you know, to be able to be scheduled, because this was decided on well after the schedule. And I think after the season, yeah, had begun, there was no all-star break. There was certainly no way to get there. So, you know, first you have to sort of convince all of the owners and Landis to even go for it before you.
He had to start with Landis, of course, mm-hmm, who basically said, "Well, talk to everybody else and see what they think," because he wanted to protect his reputation. Mm-hmm. So then it became convince the league presidents, and Ward did a great job of that, because, you know, the initial concern obvious was, well, it's in the middle of the season. You know, how are we going to, you know, schedule something in the middle of the season? And he figured out that there was actually only one major league game being played on July 6th, because it was after the 4th of July series. Then most of the teams were either headed east or west. Chicago was right at the center, so it wouldn't be that difficult to, you know, orchestrate this game in Chicago. And he had answers to the questions about, you know, what if nobody wants to buy tickets? And, mm-hmm, and he really did make it happen. And he worked his way through one by one until he came to the last two holdouts, who were the owners of the Boston Braves and the New York Giants. And he essentially arm twisted them by threatening to delve into their prior relationships with Arnold Rothstein, the famous gambler and gangster. And so they acquiesced. And by then, you know, everybody was aboard. You know, the real signature turning point was, I mean, the one person they knew they had to have from the beginning was Babe Ruth. And very early on, he made it known that he wanted to do it. And so, you know, a lot of the players, National League players, said, hey, if we get to be on the same field with Babe Ruth, I'm in.
There's a very distinct sort of Babe Ruth way of speaking, which I always get a kick out of. And when they asked him about it, his quote was, "I hope they count me in on it," which, yeah, you could just picture him saying that. "I hope they count me in on that." Like, he's a very, very kind of boisterous, you know, 1920s, 1930s way of speaking. And Arch Ward is also a very fascinating character. We've talked about him in the context of the All-America Football Conference in the 40s, you know, founding of the Golden Gloves. Tell us a little bit about who Arch Ward was.
Well, it says a lot that Arch Ward's he has one biographer who is, and the title of the book is Arch, a promoter, not a poet. You know, he wasn't much of a writer, but he was a great promoter. And he proved it very early on by when he was working at Notre Dame and spread the story nationwide that Newt Rockne had given this great halftime speech in which he, you know, urged his players to win one for the Gipper and, you know, for George Gipp, the great player who had died young. Now, whether Rockne ever said that or not is questionable, but it became the most famous phrase in the history of sports, you know, because Arch Ward spread it all over the country.
So what do they do? Tell us a little bit about the selection process. Once they start once they've decided that they're going to have this game, how do they elect the players? Because you're not doing this on your phone in those days. You're not doing it on the computer. You're not even doing it with ballots at the ballpark. How do they do this?
Well, it was paper ballots, but yeah. Initially Arch Ward's idea was that everything would be done through the Chicago Tribune.
Of course.
And it was evidence of how much, nobody was quite prepared for the level of enthusiasm from the fans, but then it was fans all over the country and all of the newspapers all over the country said, well, we're not going to let the Chicago Tribune, grab this all by themselves. So they petitioned the commissioner's office, and Landis decided, they all have to be able to print ballots too, but they can be counted at the Tribune. So in the end, like 50 papers from all over the country, including on the West Coast, where, which really made a difference for a number of players. They got, a huge number of their votes from the West Coast and made the game when they wouldn't have if not for them.
Yeah, and I think you said that there were more players from California than anywhere else, right?
More from the state of California. In fact, more from the city of San Francisco. That's, San Francisco contributed more players to the first All-Star game than New York, Boston, and Philadelphia combined.
Yeah, I was going to say that we're still about 25 years from there being teams in California, but there sure as hell were a lot of players from California, specifically the...
I grew up on the West Coast, so a lot of people, felt that PCL was equal to the major leagues.
In those days, especially
in the San Francisco Seals, and other teams. They had big attendance, great teams, great players who, some of them, spent seasons where they could have been major league stars, playing in San Francisco in particular.
And it's interesting, some of this stuff, how universal it is that, here we are on the first All-Star game and it's not even known that it's going to be an annual thing. And there's complaints about the fans from this team or ballot stuffing, or they're voting for guys who aren't having good years, maybe had good careers. They're getting in on legacy. Like, it's nice to know that even 100 years on, some of that stuff is still, the conversation hasn't changed all that much about some of that stuff.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Arch Ward was sort of the arbiter of it all. And so he would complaining that the fans were electing people that, who weren't having great seasons. And it was supposed to be who is the best right now. And one in particular he complained about was Lefty O'Doul, but Lefty was beloved on the West Coast. He was a great player and he was having a bit of an off season, but the fans had seen him, hit .398 with 254 hits just a couple of seasons earlier. So, he'd had this fantastic career on the West Coast. So he got overwhelming support from the West Coast that, lifted him onto the team. So, and a lot of people felt, Arch Ward was putting his finger on the scale for Chicago players. And there's some evidence that that might be true, just a couple of close calls, but, he was continually defending himself against that, saying, no, the people are voting this way. And, Poughkeepsie and, all across the, country.
Now you referenced our hometown where Dan and I are both from the Poughkeepsie area.
Yeah. So I did know that.
Well, this was really right up our wheelhouse because a lot of the FDR stuff, and we grew up right by Hyde Park and old, baseball from almost 100 years ago. So this was right in our wheelhouse. It's an interesting time, obviously, for the country, but for baseball too, because you know, Ruth we mentioned and having him involved is important, but this is Babe Ruth at the tail end. You know, 33 would be his last really good year, or last good year, you know, by 35 he's on the Braves and doesn't make it through. So
true.
How important, you know, was it, do you think, that Ruth is you know, wants to be involved? Because there's a scenario where it's late in his career, it's the middle of the season, where, you know, a guy might, you know, somebody in his position might just say, go on without me, whatever. Would the game have been a success if Ruth had said, no, I'm going to stay in New York?
Not as much, not nearly. I mean, you know, we all know the legend of Babe Ruth, and, you know, it's like you can't, you know, you feel like nothing more can be said. But honestly, until I began working on this book, I didn't realize his enormity. I mean, you know, I knew he was a great player, you know, alleged, you know, the greatest player ever. I knew, you know, the broad strokes of his statistics, but I didn't really understand how completely he towered over the game and towered over America at the time. He was easily the biggest sports figure in American history. People try to say, well, what about Michael Jordan? And my answer to that is, well, Babe Ruth was out sick one season, and attendance at American League games dropped by 34%. Michael Jordan's out with an injury. NBA attendance isn't going to drop by 3.4%. That, you know, Babe Ruth was that big.
Yeah, he almost seems like the equivalent of like a front man to a band. Like, you know, as opposed to like a player. Oh, you go to a game and we're Yankees fans, you know, me and Dan. If we go to a game and Aaron Judge is not in the lineup, disappointed, but it's still whatever. You go to see a band and the lead singer isn't there, you're like, I want my money back. And Ruth is really the guy who had that kind of rock star stature before there was rock and roll music. Where, like, if you got to see Babe Ruth, even if he played for two innings in an exhibition, it was worth however far you had to go and however much you had to pay.
Yeah, yeah. Just to see Babe Ruth was, even the players felt that way. And bear in mind, you know, I mean, the fans knew too that Babe was fat and almost 40. You know, he was really on his last legs. I mean, he was still a little dangerous at the plate, but not exactly gliding around in the outfield. And, but, you know, everybody wanted him to be there. And I think everybody hoped that he would come through. And there was something, you know, that added to my fascination with Babe Ruth would be he would be in these moments where everybody hoped and expected, in particular, like the first game ever played at Yankee Stadium. Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted Babe Ruth to be the first one to hit a home run at Yankee Stadium, which is an enormous amount of pressure. But Babe Ruth, in fact, did hit the first home run at Yankee Stadium, and he hit the first home run in an All-Star game.
Yeah, I've always thought of Ruth being able to participate in the first couple of All-Star games, hit the first home run. I've always thought of that as sort of similar to, like, to Vince Lombardi winning the first two Super Bowls, right? It's, you know, the timing of this new event fits perfectly, because they could have, you know, just as easily started the All-Star game in 1936 when Babe Ruth was retired. But there's something special about the fact that Ruth was able to participate and hit a home run in the very first one that gives it that sort of extra stamp of historical importance.
Yeah, mythic importance, really. I mean, it was tremendously uplifting to the country to see Babe Ruth do that, because, you know, there was this thirst, this hunger for constance, for an affirmation of what we believe in. And because, I mean, the country really did seem to be falling apart. A lot of people, you know, thought the United States was literally not going to hold together. And to see this, their aging, slipping away hero step up in that moment and deliver, you know, I mean, people were deliriously happy at the game.
The other two who, you know, come to this game at an interesting point in their careers and lives are the two men who are pegged to be the managers. Yeah. And I'm fascinated with all things McGraw and the, you know, the original New York Giants, as most people born in the 80s are fascinated by John McGraw. But, you know, he's what, 6 months away from being dead? Like, you get the impression of a guy who just all the fire is gone for the most part. You know, people who were, you know, he's riding Bill Clem a little bit, but, you know,
more than a little bit from
a little bit by his standards, I guess. He didn't try to punch him. Talk a little about McGraw and, I guess, you know, Connie Mack as well, sort of their roles in the game and at the point they both were in their careers and lives, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, what they brought to the game and why I thought they were such important characters in the book is, you know, I mean, they were baseball history. Mm-hmm. They had been dominant figures in the game since the 19th century. So they provided this continuity from, you know, the dead ball era and, you know, a time when it was played, you know, with one scuffed ball and, you know, you were trying to punch through holes and, you know, work your way around the bases with, you know, hit and run and steals and, you know, whatever nefarious means McGraw would use. And they also, you know, were sort of these icons of at sort of opposite poles of baseball and, you know, human behavior. I mean, Mack was tall and slender and genteel, soft-spoken, very, you know, determined and competitive. But, you know, McGraw was short, stout, pugnacious, you know, willing to do just, I mean, he didn't have any respect for good losers. There's nothing worse in his mind than being a good loser. You know, I don't want to hear about good losers. And so anything you did to not be a loser was okay by him. And so rules were really merely suggestions to John McGraw. And they'd live through an era when, you know, they'd go play the Temple Cup, which was I'm talking to a couple of people who actually know all this stuff, which never happens. But
well, we hope you're talking to more than a couple of people, because I think hopefully we have an audience that knows too. But we can only hope.
Yeah. Well, it's my seventh interview of the day, so my voice is going. I'm sorry about that.
No, no need to apologize at all.
So, a time when, you know, you played on the opponent's home field, yet in the omnibus, which was, you know, a large wagon coach, you know, back to the hotel, they had to cover their heads with their mitts because people were hurling rocks and bricks at them on the way back to the hotel. I mean, that was the world. You know, and what they find, you know, when they won the Temple Cup, they were all happy to be getting out of town without fractured skulls and with $600 in their pocket. So, you know, they knew that baseball were part of that, and they'd managed to steer through that into the transition. They'd both won World Series, you know, in this new era of baseball. The era of home runs and, you know, clearing the bases. And so they proved that, you know, they could master the game in various incarnations.
Yeah, and it's
the two archetypes sort of the first 30, really the going to the eight from the 1880s until about the era we're talking about, of like the two different types of guys there were in baseball. There was sort of the staid, gentlemanly, athletics is the highest form of, you know, gentlemanly competition. And then there's just punch everyone you see until you win the game. And it's like, they both had these hugely distinguished careers and seemed to have a mutual respect for the way they did it.
Mutual admiration, really. I mean, they admired each other. And, you know, I mean, you know, McGraw's favorite player was Christy Mathewson, who was the epitome of sort of, you know, the regal, you know, bearing and, you know, the gentleman player. So, you know, he was a mass of contradictions, which made him, you know, a really interesting character to write about.
And one of the things that was funny to me is that they seem to approach the game, this game, very differently. Mack managed, and I think there's even a quote where he basically says, you know, that he's managing it like a real game. He holds a pregame meeting and he doesn't make a lot of substitutions. And McGraw makes a lot of substitutions, and this is my favorite part, ignores the fan vote and just starts who he wants to start.
Yeah. Although Mack made his own decisions too. But Mack was certainly much more committed to winning the game, told the players before that, you know, look, my goal is to win this game. And if somebody doesn't get into the game, you know, don't take it personally, because, you know, we are going to show them who is the better league. McGraw didn't even meet with the team. You know, he just showed up at the ballpark, decided that, you know, Carl Hubbell, you know, was a Giants pitcher and, you know, the best pitcher in the National League was not going to start, that instead he was going to start Wild Bill Callahan. But on the other hand, Connie Mack decided not to start the best pitcher in baseball by far. I didn't really appreciate how great Lefty Grove was until I wrote this book. But instead, you know, to start Lefty Gomez, who was a great pitcher too, but not Lefty Grove.
I want to talk for a minute about a tradition that anybody who's complaining about that thinks it's a new thing maybe needs to read this book. Going all the way back to 1933, there was a controversy over the rule that every team had to have at least one player.
Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, forced upon everybody by the commissioner first, mm-hmm. and then the league presidents. You know, there was nobody really undeserving who got in. You know, I mean, some players were the only representative, and yes, they were probably chosen as the only representative, but I don't think there was anybody. I mean, the only players that sort of shocked the other players or the fans were actually, they were, you know, people who, I mean, they weren't picked because they were the only player from that team. They were just the idiosyncratic selections of Mack and McGraw.
Yeah. The one name here that I really have to admit I knew very little about was the lone, and this is a guy whose name sounds like he belongs on the Brooklyn Dodgers, the infielder Tony Cuccinello, who yeah. made the team over Rogers Hornsby, among others, although Hornsby is at the tail end of his career. But still, Tony Cuccinello is, you know, you got the Ruths and the Groves and the yeah. Gehrigs and the Hubbles, and then Tony Cuccinello. That's the one that kind of stuck out a little bit for me. Yeah.
Well, I can see that. And, you know, not that he, you know, he was a terrific player, but, you know, a lot of people didn't think he was, you know, deserved the position. The Cubs fans in particular were upset because, you know, their guy they thought was what should be, you know, either the starting or the backup second baseman. But, you can see that, but you know, there were the players themselves, you know, weren't complaining at the time. I mean, Jimmy Fox, who was arguably the greatest slugger in baseball at the time, didn't get into the game. And a lot of fans were furious about it. But he didn't say a word of complaint. You know, Mr. Mack has his, you know, strategy, and who am I to question it?
You know, it's funny to think, you know, the Connie Mack, as we talk about, sort of the old Lions of baseball in 1933 would be the A's manager for like 20 more seasons. And yeah. really, really, and I think you get into it a little of like, does how long he held on sort of diminish his legacy at all? And
yeah, it is painful.
Yeah.
You know, to write and to read about, you know, that this great manager ended up with a losing record. You know, he won more games than any other manager in baseball, but he lost more too.
And well,
finished under 500.
I think that's the thing too, is he didn't hang around 2 years too long. He hung around 15 years past when he should have been there.
That, you know. He was 70 at the time of the All-Star game, you know, mm-hmm. and he's going to stick around for another 20 years yeah. almost.
I know we're probably going to want to talk about the East-West game before we wrap up here. So I just figured we'd mention the game itself, the All-Star game itself. Obviously highlighted by the Ruth home run is, you know, far and away the highlight of the game. I don't know how much else, you know, the American League wins the game. I don't know how much else we need to
talk about. Well, it really fascinated people that, you know, fans at the time were even more impressed by the defensive play of the game, which, you know, it delighted and flabbergasted and, you know, them that it was made by Babe Ruth, who was not great in the field, but he made a great home run saving catch at the wall on a drive that by Chick Caffey that probably would have cleared the fence. So, you know, afterward, people were talking about his catch as much as they were talking about his home run.
Yeah, and Ruth is probably a better fielder than he gets credit for, but not in 1933. He wasn't.
He was a great athlete when he was young, truly a great all-around athlete. You know, most people have seen the, you know, footage of him, you know, trotting around the bases, you know, in his top heavy way, you know, from, you know, when he was in his late 30s. But
the clip from 1948 when he's dying, you know, and they think that's what he looked like his whole life. Dan, did you have anything else before we talked about the East-West game and the Negro Leagues?
Well, I guess my other question for you, Randall, is how soon after this game did they decide that it was going to be an every year thing? Or at least did they decide that it was going to not be a one-time thing, that they wanted to do it again? Was that immediate or did it take some time?
They didn't even start really talking about it until the winter meetings. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, hey, look, this worked. You know, the fans, I mean, the stadium was sold out. You know, it was great for the city of Chicago. It'd be great for another city, and you know, but basically the fans love it, and you know, and it's profitable and it's good for the game. So, and the second All-Star game is pretty legendary too because of Carl Hubbell's performance.
5 Hall of Famers in a row. Yeah, so I think Andrew alluded to it, but you devote a couple of chapters to the East-West game, which is the first ever, which is the Negro League equivalent of the All-Star game, and the first ever East-West game follows at the same ballpark at Comiskey Park in Chicago about 3 months later.
Yeah.
Did the success of the white All-Star game lead Negro League baseball to want to do its own?
Well, yes. And, you know, they also saw it quite reasonably. Gus Greenlee, who was the driving force who owned the Pittsburgh Crawfords, saw it as a chance to, you know, put, you know, the game that the Negro League players played in front of fans. They got a big boost from Babe Ruth, who was always an advocate of, you know, integrating baseball. But, you know, right before that East-West game, he gave an interview to the Chicago Defender saying, "I really hope white fans will come out and see the brand of, you know, of baseball these guys play. I mean, it, you know, they, there's a special sparkle." And, you know, and Babe Ruth was already beloved in the black community for a whole lot of reasons. Main one being that he was always so willing to play against Negro League players in exhibition games and treated them and black people in general with such dignity. But so, you know, that was another incentive. But really, you know, they were determined to, you know, showcase what they could do, and they wanted to do it on the same field where the Major League All-Stars had played. So, you know, in a way, it was a way, sort of putting it in the face of America that, you know, you didn't have all of the best players in that game, because some of the best players are going to be in this game.
Yeah, and I have to say, this might be you know, without making a definitive statement, this might be the greatest collection of Negro League era black baseball talent in baseball history. Just looking at the lineups here, Cool Papa Bell, Oscar Charleston, Judd Wilson, Biz Mackey, Willie Wells, Turkey Stearns, Mule Suttles, Big Bill Foster, Judy Johnson, Satchel Paige. You know, other than the fact that Josh Gibson's not there, this might be.
He was there.
Oh, was he there?
He was. But
I don't have him written down as a starter. That's my fault.
He didn't have a great game, but okay. But he did get in. Hit long fly ball out. You know, that was his first season of being a real star in the Negro League. So, you know, other people got more votes and more attention, even though a lot of the players felt that he was the best player.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I have Biz Mackey over Josh Gibson here, but
he was the starter. But
gotcha.
Not in the game. And it was, as it happened, Mule Suttle sort of stole the show. But in a way, Satchel Paige stole the show by not showing up.
That's Satchel.
Yeah, well, if he was, if they weren't going to start him, he wasn't coming, basically.
Yeah.
And I think in a way, the All-Star game, the format of one All-Star game is almost designed to showcase the Negro Leagues, because obviously the Negro Leagues was always going to, you know, we're always going to struggle organizationally and financially with teams being able to stay throughout the season and playing a full schedule and everything. But in the structure of sort of, here is our best players playing one game, you couldn't come up with a better format for, you know, to showcase the talent in the Negro Leagues at that point.
It's absolutely true, but although it's also true, sadly, that there weren't very many white fans at the game. It was mostly black people. The Cubs were playing that day across town, but the East-West game actually outdrew them slightly in terms of fans. There's a great photograph of the stands, and it's just this sea of black faces with one white guy sitting on the end, staring into the camera. So, and I wonder who that guy was. But you know, it was also a demonstration of how great the players were, and it was also a demonstration just by who they all were, that there was one Negro Leagues team that could have competed with any other major league team. They could have competed for a pennant in either league, and that was the Pittsburgh Crawfords. Gus Greenlee had put together by far the best team in the history of the Negro Leagues, and he had an array of, you know, future Hall of Famers, on his team bus.
Yes, he absolutely did. One of the greatest teams, really one of the greatest dynasties, you know, collection of talent in any sport, in any American sport, is those Pittsburgh Crawfords teams in the 1930s. Well, Randall, this book is excellent. It really kind of tells the whole story, not just of this game, but of America, of Chicago at the time, and the a history of the first half century of Major League, or the first half of the 20th century in Major League Baseball, going back to all sorts of things like the Merkel Boner of 1908 and, you know, Ruth's called shot. You really kind of touch it all. And I think we would really suggest
they're really all relevant to the story.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But yeah, well, thank you.
And I would say that it really is sort of a great primer of the lives of these players and how they all converged on this one day in 1933 in Chicago. So thanks for joining us, and really enjoyed the book.
Well, thanks for having me, you guys. And it's really a pleasure to be interviewed by people who know more than I do.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. Go ahead, Andrew. I'm sorry.
I definitely don't. My brother, he's kind of in a class by himself, but you know, it's we like to have people on who we're interested in the subject matter and can, you know, we feel like at least hold somewhat our own in the conversation. So,
yeah, well, you do that.
Well,
thanks.
Thank you so much, Randall. And we encourage everybody to head out and buy the book. One more time, the book is The First All-Star Game: Babe Ruth, FDR, and America at the Crossroads. And our guest has been the author, Randall Sullivan. Thank you again for joining us. Andrew, thank you again for doing this with me as always. And we will be back soon. But until then, I'm Dan Newman.
And I'm Andrew Newman. Goodbye, old sports.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website, seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sports.historynetwork.com.
You could be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.